I had been warned by Mr. Eyeball that snow was white and cold. But it was not white. It held all the colors of the spectrum. It was blue and green and yellow and teal. There were delicate pink tintings in some of the cliffs as we passed. As the light shifted in the sky, so too did the snow around us deepen, find new hues, the way an ocean is never blue, but some constantly changing color. Now was the cold, simply cold. It was the devouring of heat, a complete sucking of warmth from the blood until what remained was the absence of heat. When the wind stirred, it would scythe through the skin as if we were the cane and the wind were a terrible reaping. North we went, north and then west, and then north again. We stopped to rest the dogs. Our guide tethered them to stakes he had driven into the ice to keep them from attacking each other. They sat, hunched white mounds of fur ruffling in the wind, their eyes slivered shut. I made a quick, vivid sketch in pencil, wondering at their ferocity. Our guide passed us a small cube of what Titch explained must be blubber. It tasted rank, oily, but I did not complain. And all the while, we spoke very little about what we were venturing towards or what we were leaving behind. I thought of my life at Faith, and it all seemed a figment, a distant, vicious dream.
Welcome to episode 2 of Lady Fiction. I'm Stephanie Schaefer, and you just heard a quote from the novel we're talking about today, Essie Edugen's Washington Black, published in 2018. It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, received the Giller Prize, and was praised by the New York Times and the Washington Post as one of the best novels of the year. And it's specifically intriguing because of how it looks at the history of science and literature's and art's powers of storytelling and rendering perception. On this podcast, literature's powers of storytelling and the history of science have become a bit of a recurring theme. We talked about the history of gynecology last year, and in episode 1 of 2022, Sam Pinto discussed with me the epistemologies and oversights of the archive and the legacy of celebrity performance by Black women in the past and present. As we will see in Washington Black, science is produced by white men who draw extensively on the labors and skills of a Black boy, the protagonist and storyteller of Edugen's novel. Here with me today to discuss this in detail is my colleague Nele Zavallisch. Dr. Zavallisch is assistant professor, junior professorin for American literature at Trier University and an expert on African-Canadian and African-American studies. Her doctoral monograph on autobiographical and slave narratives by Black authors in mid-19th century Canada appeared as Fugitive Borders in 2019 and is now also available open access from Transkript Verlag. Neil is currently examining the interconnections of sentimentality, gender, and comedy in U.S. culture and has published in national and international venues, including Zeitschrift für Kanada-Studien, the Journal of Transnational American Studies, and Atlantic Studies Global Currents. Welcome, Nele.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Steffi. I'm very happy to be with you.
And I'm happy to have you. So let's start talking about the opening quote about the perceptions of snow that Washington Black walks into and how this kind of encapsulates the general storytelling tone of the novel, and then take it a little bit from there. So we heard that snow has so many different colors, and it's also a threatening environment to humans that Washington Black finds himself in. But he uses art to depict what he sees.
Exactly. And I selected this quote first for this kind of symbolic layer that you outlined, as well as the kind of spatial component, which is so important to the novel, right? Because of course, the snow does not occur in Canada or in the United States, but in the Arctic, where Washington finds himself along with this strange man, Christopher Wilde, who's called Titch. And so they end up in the Arctic looking for Titch's father, who's also a scientist. And so it stood out to me because I thought that we could see how, you know, Washington walks through life with open eyes and how he's full of wonder and amazement of the things that he sees, but also how perceptive he is and how he manages to sort of tease out meaning, also for us as readers, from his changing and very contrasting environments. And so the Arctic is just one of the spaces that he visits and that he experiences. And it's a signal space because, of course, as part of the sort of Great White North imaginary, it is part of Canada as well, which is where the author is from. So I thought it was kind of a nice roundup. But as I said, you know, it's only one of the stations of the novel as a whole, right?
Yeah. And it's important to note, when we talk about the protagonist and storyteller, so the person or the narrative instance who renders this to us, this is a black boy who grew up on, until the age of 10, I think, grew up on a plantation in Barbados and leaves that plantation and goes on this fantastic trip where he goes through different spaces and places and renders them to us. So there's a meta layer. Of course, on the one hand, he has descriptions like this, or a description of, mm-hmm. of how he looks at the moon through a reflectoscope. But he also tells of his travels to us in the novel,
exactly.
which are, on the one hand, improbable, and on the other hand, maybe also overlooked. And that's the history of science part that I find so intriguing. So let's talk about the protagonist a little bit. What's up mm-hmm. with this Washington Black?
And what a fascinating character he is. I mean, on the one hand, you know, he is our focalizer, right? So everything we know through Washington and through his eyes. So this is a very intimate narrative setting that we're thrown into, which kind of contrasts with this all-encompassing, globe-trotting adventure narrative. And we can talk about genre here in a second. But so this is where we start out on this slave plantation on, you know, entitled Faith, or is called Faith on Barbados.
In 1830, that's important too. I mean, you
exactly.
say that
that's very important.
In 1830, it's a mm-hmm. very 19th century novel also.
Yes. Yes, so it's a historical novel that picks up on the 19th century, the early 19th century, that is, very astutely. So we're, you know, in the antebellum period, if we talk about the United States, we talk about pre-Confederation Canada, we talk about the Caribbean, which has seen the independence of Haiti in 1804, but which is still very much engulfed in the transatlantic slave trade and in the history of slavery, which is very present. And I mean, this is the kind of context, of course, that Washington lives and experiences himself. So the horrors of slavery are present in this first part of the novel, very much so, because he grows up in enslavement himself. And so the owner of the plantation, who is Erasmus Wilde, this privileged, arrogant, terrible white Englishman who oversees the plantation, you know, for his family, he is the stereotypical gruesome, cruel, ignorant slaveholder that you can imagine. And so this is a hot, humid, geographical place, this plantation. And this is where Washington comes of age and lives until he's 10 or 11. That's right. So.
And then he leaves. Let's talk
exactly.
about how he leaves. It's a crazy story of how he leaves. I was wondering is it an elopement or is it an, I don't even know
yes.
what this is.
So, I mean, and this is why the novel is so intriguing
mm-hmm.
from a genre point of view, but also from a narratological point of view, because the way Washington leaves, and I want to come back to this later, it sounds incredible. It sounds so improbable. But Erasmus Wilde's brother shows up, Christopher, who is called Titch. And so he chooses Washington as an assistant. Titch is an aspiring scientist himself, so following the footsteps of his father, also trying to sort of impress his father. And he has built, or he wants to build, a hot air balloon, which he calls the Cloud Cutter. And this first part of the novel is very dense because Washington is forced to leave Faith Plantation along with Titch following some unexpected events that are very, very dramatic and traumatizing. And so Titch resolves to take Washington to save him from Erasmus Wilde and those who might come after them. And they leave in this hot air balloon crossing the sea. So, you know, by any means, the reader is thrown into a narrative that starts with a very cruel and traumatizing beginning. And then, you know, to add to that, the protagonist, who we've just gotten to know, is forced to leave under such dramatic circumstances. And that really triggers his journeys across the Western Hemisphere, if you will. And so this is very much an adventure novel, but it is so many other things as well.
Yeah, yeah. So the adventure part would be the improbability or the incredibility of him going all these places. So in between, he leaves from Barbados, then goes on to Virginia.
Yes.
Goes on a ship. So he also takes all those wonderful technologically advanced transportation devices with the cloud cutter and the ship. He goes to Virginia. There, Titch tells him that once you touch ground, you will be subjected to the laws of freedom in the United States. The American, wonderful American laws of freedom. And what happens is that he quickly realizes that he is being... he's being hunted by because there's been there's prize money on his head, so he becomes very frightened. And from Virginia, he goes to the Arctic. From there, he goes to Nova Scotia, and he ends up in the center of all things of the colonizing world, and that's London. So it's a movement from a plantation through the New World to the very side of the Old World. And that's the adventure part. And you always wonder what happens next.
Exactly. And let's not forget that although the final part, which is the fourth part of the novel, is entitled England or London, England, the very, very end of the novel takes yet another incredible step when Washington and his, you know, the love of his life, Tana Goff, end up in Morocco. And I don't want to say too much, but this is an important geographical outlier, if you will, here as well. And I mean, the ending is a whole different kind of beast, I would say. But so let's not forget that either. So, yes, we are in the colonial center, but then we are also in this space in Morocco, which is very interesting. And it's kind of a different, it gives a different hue and a different note to the novel as well.
Yeah.
So, yes, adventure in the sense of geography, unexpected mobility, right? So we're in the context for sort of from a scholarly point of view, right? We have to think about Black mobilities in the 19th century under slavery and beyond. So the different kinds of regimes that Washington encounters in the Caribbean, in the United States, in Canada, all of these places touched and influenced and affected, sometimes dominated by slavery, but the quality changes in each instance. And then, of course, you know, the Arctic, which seems geographically, even ideologically, very far removed from the places he has known. But even there, I find the dominant topos of the novel, and this is why I've also chosen this other quote, is the topos of strangeness. And so I think that is something that immediately sprung to me from the page, the idea of constant unease that Washington is experiencing. And that is related to epistemological strangeness, but also the fact that he can't wrap his head around the people he meets, most of them white people.
Yeah. And most of them, and this is it's the other generic or genre discussion that we need to have, obviously, is the slave narrative as a backdrop. So as as the story evolves, his narrative voice also comes to maturity. So we start out with the narrative perspective of a young boy, And as you said, he often can't get his head around the things he sees. He's clearly haunted mm-hmm. by his fears, and he can never be wholeheartedly open with white people to begin with. So mm-hmm. he remains suspicious because he knows that they might turn into, you know, a lethal threat at any point. And so even mm-hmm. when, as he has, I think we can call it a friendship with Titch, who leaves him. And then later on, he has a relationship that's friendly, more in a patriarchal way, or more in a father-son relationship with botanist, with a naturalist, mm-hmm. Also a white person. He's called Goff in the novel. He's modeled on Philip Henry Goss, mm-hmm. the historic person. These relationships are key because these figures function as enablers. Yeah. They educate him. They take him places and they show him things, but they also profit from him. And that's where I was so intrigued when you said to me, when we talked about this, the slave narrative is a backdrop, because in John Sikora's words, it comes a little bit as a black message in a white envelope. The novel takes this up, I think, the making of a story from a black person mm. through a white kind of framing or interfering or editing device.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's so many things I have to say about that. I think, so first of all, the genre of the slave narrative is an obvious intertext that we can consider because, well, it is the story of someone who is born into slavery, but then escapes from slavery in a very wondrous kind of manner, and then also experiences life in freedom and what that kind of means. He reinvents himself. He discovers his artistry. He makes a living out of this artistry eventually. He meets the love of his life. He meets all kinds of difficult, complex, sometimes friendly, white people, partly interested in abolitionism. But as you said, you know, the relationship is always complex because, of course, they are implicated in the system of slavery, whether they want to or not. And that is Titch's biggest problem, right? So he's born into a family that are, you know, that are rich and privileged. They profit from slavery. They own slaves. They own slaveholding lands. And so as much as he wants to not be a part of that, he struggles with, but I very much am. And so he is this kind of messed up personality who wants to maybe do good in the world or do good by Washington, but who also fails in some respects. And that is, yes. of course, a topic that we see in many slave narratives as historical documents, right? So this trajectory from slavery to freedom, dealing with white abolitionists, men and women, by the way. And so what, and finding your voice, asserting your identity, et cetera, et cetera. Steffi, I loved when you wrote to me with some questions that we could address. And you said, you know, names are so telling in the novel because, of course, our protagonist is called George Washington Black, right? So which encompasses this paradox of the so-called New World. So George Washington, the first president of the United States, an inspiration to name our protagonist. But then at the same time, it's, of course, a nation that is founded upon the paradox of slavery that is inscribed into the Constitution. And so Washington, growing up, finds himself haunted by this paradox. And so that is also at the heart of the slave narrative. This is why the genre is also so relevant. Aside from the different kinds of geographical moves, so Black mobility, which is also always relevant in the slave narrative, and so on and so forth. But I think the reason why I was drawn to this novel so much is I find one very powerful intertext, and I've mentioned that to you, is Olotta Equiano, Gustavus Vassa, the interesting narrative of the life of Equiano, a slave narrative, arguably, and I'm putting that into question here, that came out in two volumes in 1789. This is by all accounts, an extraordinary narrative. Because again, like this novel that we're reading, this historical novel, it can be many things. It is an adventure novel, a coming of age story, the narrative of a Black Atlantic citizen of the 18th century, a scientific account, an abolitionist tract, and so many things. All of this is also contained in Washington Black. And so Equiano is someone who is born into slavery. So you know, who experiences relationships of all kinds to white people who promise him freedom, who promise him work, who betray him, who resell him. Eventually, he is freed, liberated, and then becomes a kind of seafaring person who visits all kinds of different places, including, and here is my big, of course, moment of enlightenment, the North Pole. So Equiano ends up at the North Pole with Dr. Irving. And so they want to find a passage to India. And so he's part of this expedition and they end up in the North Pole. And this is, you know, his description of the ice around him is, of course, very reminiscent of what Washington Black is doing. They become trapped in the ice, so there's this moment of danger, and so on and so forth. So there are many obvious parallels, I find, between this historical person, Equiano, and the novel that we're reading. And so, you know, of course, we have to talk about the slave narrative as the formative genre before the Civil War, before Confederation in Canada. And so it is underlying, but that is also to say that the slave narrative has always been a genre that consists of many different genres, sentimental novel, adventure story, autobiography, and so on and so forth. And this is also a great prism to consider Washington Black as the novel.
Yes. And what I find so intriguing specifically about Lauda Equiano's story and the slave narrative as a genre is the very difficult truth claims attached to it. So it has a documentary quality, and that's what I meant when I talked about the black message, white envelope thing. So of course this is built on real historic persons, but the contents and the way that the narrative is rendered have been tempered with. In the slave narrative, this happened through white editors, and in Washington Black, we have the same thing happening, but on a level where we get to explore the workings of perspective and how these white men, well-meaning abolitionist white men, mm-hmm. deal with Wash, our protagonist. And one thing that I really like is how Edugyn plays the workings of perspective against authority. And this is also maybe a good seek to the archive, the history of science and these things, because there's a wonderful portrait when he sees for the first time mm-hmm. Titch's father in the Arctic, because they go looking for him. He seems to have faked his own death, but it turns out yep. he didn't die. That's a bit of a spoiler alert. And then Titch, of course, is happy to see his father. And then Wash also sees this person. And I'm going to quickly read out the quote here because it's so beautiful. And it shows how Washington Black, the protagonist, also becomes an artist in character description. And then I glimpsed him, a man rising from the shadows. Like a figure from myth, the great patriarch of the wilds, fellow of the Royal Society, recipient of the Copley Medal and the Bakerian Lectureship. The man whose learning had kindled his son's mind and never burned down. The man who had drawn us north through ice field and hazard. Against what odds? Oh, that man, though whose very treatise on the icy nature of comets once left the Sorbonne in chaos, whose learning could be expressed in 12 languages, who admired the jokes of the Tartars and the salads of the Incas, who had instructed his 3-year-old son to scoop when his hand held a knife and to cut it when it held a spoon. For no person ought to assume a tool's use is determined by the tool. The man of 1,000 lifetimes who had set his heavy English leather boots on the soil of 5 continents and collected the mud from each. I saw him, and I kneeled, dripping in the low entrance, staring. For he was short, fat, and under his scraggly whiskers was a face very much alive and quite brutally ugly. So I totally love this because it's funny, you know. She takes the monument, establishes the guy on the pedestal. This is the Royal Society fellow, yada, yada, yada. A little later, we find out he has no front teeth, but he replaced them with little wooden sticks. So imagine how horrible the guy must have looked. And he probably smelled really bad as well. So Washington is an observer who sees these things and who renders them with a dramaturgy of his own. And that's what I like so much about the perspective of the mm-hmm. novel. So this is, when we engage the slave narrative, I think this is also a claim to take the voice back.
Yes.
To the observer, into the experiencer, and have people have their own voice, the enslaved.
Exactly. And I thank you for bringing this up, because I think one thing to be said about the slave narrative is we, of course, have to acknowledge the infringement or infringements of white editors and amanuenses and, you know, abolitionists who funded publication, whatever. But we should always keep in mind the possibility for agency of the black subject or the black author, right? So in how far is the slave narrative also always a document to how black people can retain control over the stories, and in many slave narratives they do, right? And so I think Washington Black in that sense is of course doing exactly that, right? So Washington is an astute observer, because that's what he has learned to do. Growing up in a place where you're not supposed to talk, have an opinion, or even so much as breathe on your own, he has learned to interpret everything around him. The people, their looks, the tone of their voice, the way they dress, the way they behave. And this is what he does here as well, right? So he knows that Titch's father is supposed to be this grand embodiment of Western science, you know. But then when he meets the guy, it turns out, well, you know, he's just a regular dude. Like, he's an old man who's suffering from all kinds of illnesses. You know, he's fragile and struggling with his life. And, you know, I mean, we never kind of resolve the family history of the Wilds, but it is truly wild in the truest sense. Yes. Right? So. And I mean, and this is why, of course, as you say, this is also a novel about meaning making in the sense of how is science a process of meaning making? Who gets to determine what are we exploring? How do we interpret so-called facts? Who is, you know, going on these explorations into the Arctic or, you know, into the deep ends of the sea? And how do processes of marginalization work within science? And so Edugyn, who has shown time and again that she's concerned with marginalized voices, people whose stories are buried, forgotten, repressed, she here creates a protagonist who, against all odds in a way, finds his journey and his vocation, and who knows or who comes to sort of learn how to deal with these white scientists and these white abolitionists who try to still, like, cut him out of the picture.
Yeah, and we need to talk about that too. So this is a novel about the history of science. Notably, we have this Titch person who mm-hmm. invents the cloud cutter and who mm-hmm. teaches Wash a lot. But the second father figure, a white scientist who's mm-hmm. important here, is Philip Henry Goss, who I talked about before. The so-called inventor of the aquarium mm-hmm. And the popularizer of natural science. And this has a lot to do with visual culture. And Wash is key in this. So Wash is the observer, and when he meets Goss for the first time, they start talking. And in the novel, it's not Goss who invents the aquarium, without spoiling it. And it's also not Goss who does all the drawings of the underwater fauna mm-hmm. Off mm-hmm. the coast of Nova Scotia that then becomes so interesting to the audiences in the London mm-hmm. Zoo. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's an untold story that's there, untold history also that's there in the novel. And we have to ask ourselves, I mean, we open these books and read about this guy invented this, this person invented that, he's a fellow of the Royal Society. But then it becomes clear, as Edugyn tells us, that, you know, there's a lot of gratuitous labor, a lot of coincidence, and a lot of things that go unnoticed.
Exactly. And exploitation.
Don't surface in the history books.
Exactly. Yeah. And exploitation in the sense that Goff is very aware that the talented artist is not himself or his daughter, of course, but Washington Black. And so the kind of, I also love how Edugyn sets this up in the novel, right? Through these evening conversations over dinner, Washington sort of lays out his idea for the aquarium, how it might be possible to transport animals from Nova Scotia to England across the Atlantic. you know, a feat unheard of and unsuccessful so far. And then by and by, you know, Goff kind of convinces himself that it is his idea. You know, and this is a very cool kind of parallel to academia, because lo and behold, you know, you know, I mean, as a doctoral
student, I convince myself all my ideas are always mine, never anyone else's.
Exactly. So, but in all seriousness, of course, what Edugen is doing sometimes through humor, is to raise awareness for the kind of whitewashing of science, whitewashing of history that we see time and again. And here, of course, Washington is, it's his idea, it's his technologies, his experimentation that lead to the successful, erection, you know, building of the aquarium, back in London. And she draws on histories that we know, you know, Matthew Hansen, African American, first explorer of the Arctic, not Robert Peary. So also a story that is under rug swept, and other instances as well. You know, who knows of our students? I'm thinking of the American Studies classroom. Who knows of Benjamin Banneker? Most people know of white scientists, rather, right? So these processes and strategies they're also something that Edugen picks up on.
Yes. So the question is maybe how much of this novel is, you know, a heuristic, or how up to date is this novel with contemporary conversations that we're having in academia and maybe also in, I don't know, in the public sphere.
Yeah, so I would like to bring in here a book that I've told you about that I've just bought. I'm holding this. Steffi, you can see this in the camera, right? This is Edugen's very new essay collection, and it's called Out of the Sun, Essays at the Crossroads of Race. It came out 2022, so it's really hot off the press. And this is wonderfully aligned with the novel in the sense that each of her chapters deals with a different continent, so with a different geographical space. So her second chapter is on Canada, and it's called Canada and the Art of Ghosts. And so in this chapter, she ruminates so-called ghost stories that then very immediately turn to the intersection of race and ghost stories. And so she talks about Marie-Joseph Angélique, who is this repressed figure in the history of slavery in what is Quebec today. But she also has other instances, and her point is, you know, that so much stories are being not told because they're out of the sun, you know, they're not in focus. And this is a sort of a deliberate choice that we make. We remember some people, we remember some stories and not others. And Washington is here. Washington Black is here to tell us that he will be remembered, you know. Mm-hmm. And what fascinated me reading this chapter, Canada and, you know, the history and ghosts, is that Washington Black and Titch are each other's ghosts. They haunt each other, and they can't get each other out of their heads. And as much as they try to run away from each other or run towards each other, their complicated connection is at the heart of this novel. And Titch is as much haunted by the thought of Washington Black and by his presence than Washington is haunted by the image that he has of Titch and it's the trauma of being left behind by him. And yes. So, you know, all that is to say, coming back to your question, I think that her novel is timeless in this regard, you know, and it's, you know, I mean, it came out a couple of years ago, but it's, you can read it in 2022 and you're going to be able to read it in 2026 and so on and so forth.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. It also makes an argument about the impossibility to disentangle settler colonial histories.
Yeah.
So there is no storytelling outside this logic of the Enlightenment project and the simultaneous enslavement legacy. Mm. There is no outside to this. There is no outside to the history of science as we know it. We can talk about the stories untold or the stories that are not in the light, but science is going to tell us, no, it's supposed to be some, you know, objective. It's supposed to be founded on facts. And that's what I like so much, because at the present moment, what I often think about is art's potential for really shaking things up, really asking us to reframe our epistemologies, our understandings of the world. And that's what this argument also does. It says if you are going to, you know, conscribe to science, then there's no way out. But if you're willing to live with stories that are maybe not 100% objectionable or 100% true, or, you know, where we can prove where the sources come from, then all of a sudden this becomes much more creative, much more appealing.
Exactly. I mean, I would agree in the sense that Edugyn is presenting a protagonist who is at the heart of the history of science, while at the same time showing his absolute adoration and fascination and commitment to the project of science, right? So he is truly fascinated by the discoveries he's a part of, right? So by these animals from the deep sea, by their...
But you know, he does it through art. I mean, he's an artist. Exactly. He draws them. He sees things and then he draws them. He renders them. And that's his experience. He sees things. He's fascinated, swept away. And then he draws things.
Exactly.
And that's how he amplifies this.
Exactly. And while at the same time, he's of course very aware of scientific or sort of, you know, mechanical processes of how do you keep an animal alive when your goal is to transport it back across the ocean, right? So, I mean, he's aware of all these scientific methods that are being developed or that he can build on, but you're right. His connection to the specimens or to the flora and fauna is through art, which is an important form of expression. And in the 18th and 19th centuries, this connection was much more intimate than today, right? So, I mean, you can only tell people in England about what you saw in the Arctic if you're going to be able to draw so accurately that you can present your drawings in an atlas or, you know, in a book to the audience that you find back home or wherever you're going, you know? And so this interconnection and this non-separation of the scientist and the artist, the author and the scientist at the time is what intrigues me as well.
Yeah. And it does. And I think it does translate into the present moment also in being swept away by all the images, all the imageries that you sometimes have no choice but to look at. And having to develop the kind of media literacy to sort through them.
Sure.
By yourself and to pick your own battles a little bit. So, and to decide what story is being told.
Yeah, exactly. So I think what Edugyn is doing is offering sort of an alternative version of this strand of natural science. So here, you know, it's marine biology. And in doing that, she's very much in line with calls to diversify the natural sciences, such as, or academia as a whole, you know, to sort of question our ways of understanding, of meaning making, of writing history, of making history, and so on and so forth. And so this is, I think, also a very important feature of the novel, that it partakes in that. And this is where the novel also draws its relevance from.
Yeah. So I'm thinking the first time I read this novel, I was more focused on the workings of the protagonist coming of age and maturing and then looking back at his own story and explicating it to the reader. There's a scenario of reader address where he doesn't speak directly to a reader as you, but it's there in that he looks back at his life and says, when I first heard this, I didn't think anything of it, but knowing what I know now, this sounds strange or this sounds familiar. And we have lots of these kind of meta-lepsis and commentaries that refer to the telling present. So that's the first reading I did with this novel. I was interested in the how the character goes about in its development and how the narrative voice comes of age. But now there are so many additional layers that I discovered. So there's the adventure story, the improbability of this, the fascination that, you know, I mean, just imagine going to the Arctic in the 1830s and the hardships of that. Or just imagine in being in London during this time. It's really also a fantastic entertainment that we're being offered through his perspective. And so it's become much more complicated. It's a novel where first read is like, mm-hmm, yeah, I get it. And then second read is like, oh, there's this. And oh, there's this too. And there's these mobilities. And there's these crazy inventions. And there's the beautiful paintings. And it becomes so layered.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. And I find, you know, here too, I always go back to the Equiano text because that is precisely the reaction. If you read it with students, they will show often like surprise, you know, what the North Pole, what do you mean? Like, is this real? And so the story seems improbable, but it is very much not. So there's a historical antecedent, right? And I'm not saying that in the 18th century, so-and-so many people went to the Arctic or the North Pole or whatever, but I'm saying it is in the realm of the possible and that we have proof that people were there. And so Edugyn, with this kind of novel, moving from place to place, from continent to continent, from country to country, is also part of the project that raises awareness to Black mobilities, even at the time when slavery was still present or when it was just being abolished. And so, you know, the fact that Black people have always lived in all of these kinds of places, that is also a political statement to make, right? Because it forces us, as you say, to reconsider and to question the ways in which we understand placemaking and belonging. And so mm-hmm. in the same way that she foregrounds the notion of belonging in her essay collection, belonging is equally at the center of this novel, I find, of Washington Black, because Washington tries to find belonging in his own identity, like, who am I? What does it mean for me to now be a free Black artist, to be in love with Tana, who has this complicated father? What does it mean for me to try and understand Titch, right? To be traveling the world. But at the same time, Washington is also part of these migration waves of Black people to and fro across the Atlantic, on the North American continent, in Europe, and so on and so forth. So I think that your reaction is very representative, even of my reaction to the novel as well, because you, as you dig deeper, you know, you really try to, you open yourself to these waves and to the layers that you uncover. And this is why I also think, you know, you can pick up this novel in different points, at different points in your studies or at different points in your life, and there's other things that will resonate with you. But I think it's absolutely timely, and I'm so grateful Edugyn wrote a historical novel, because sometimes I struggle, you know, no, I mean, and I mean it, you know, sometimes I struggle to point out to students that we're not done reading 18th century, 19th yeah. century texts, and it's absolutely yeah. crucial that we do that so we understand how we end up today in 2022 or whatever, you know. And so I love her care and her appreciation and her portrayal of this time, which is by all means so exciting, terrible, but also wonderful. And it forces us to sort of dive deep into that as well. And so, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to me.
And if it, there's maybe as a closing point that I'd like to make here, and I know as a fellow Canadianist, you also have a word or two to say on this. So the beauty of this novel is also that it's a Canadian and not a Canadian novel.
Correct.
Of the literary prison. So it taps into Canadianness with the different spaces that we see, but it also taps into the question of place.
Yes.
In the North American continent and in this context, and it clearly makes a display of the transatlantic space as yes. one that is entangled, that is complicated, that, you know, the protagonist travels across and goes to the different places at a certain time of discovery. Mm-hmm. And it reminds us blatantly over and over again of settler colonial histories. It doesn't distinguish between the US or Canada, for that matter. It's all equally good or equally bad. And that's why I enjoyed it when you talked about the chapter in her essay collection about Canadian ghost stories, because that is something that, which at the same time, you know, ambiguates
yeah.
Canadianness, but yeah. also sets it apart from the exceptionalist or even post-exceptionalist transnational narratives of the United States that we often see at this point in American literature. So it's a Canadian novel that we're discussing on Lady Fiction today.
Correct. And I would just like to point out, you know, there's a very deliberate choice, I think, on her part, on Dugin's part, to have the section of set in Nova Scotia, set in the year 1834. Why? Because it's the year that slavery is abolished in the British Empire. But it's also precisely 50 years after the first race riot in what we call Canada today, which took place in Shelburne, Nova Scotia, which is also the setting of this part. So, you know, Edugen, she's not holding up, you know, a sign that says, bad slavery, here it is. But she is she's writing this novel, of course, against the backdrop of slavery as a present institution and regime, both in the United States and in Canada. And it's like these little things that she has here and there where you're aware that this is a reality that Washington faces. And no, he's not free in Nova Scotia. And he faces racism and discrimination and fear of being haunted and hunted wherever he goes. And so this is also very powerful storytelling.
Mm-hmm. And yet our ideas of marine biology originate in Nova Scotia. That's mm-hmm. another decentering effort mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much to talk about. There's so many more points that we have to make, but I think we can both agree that we recommend to all our listeners to read this novel,
sure.
to read it, you know, in the American Studies, the North American Studies, Canadian Studies classroom, or what have you, and to just indulge in all the complexities that permeate through the surface of this beautiful book. So
absolutely.
Thank you so much for being my guest today, for a great conversation.
Thank you so much.
And I look forward to continuing this.
Thank you, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the AmeriCentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.